thank you for giving me a chance to sell a bit my work and my fields of interest in this workshop, and thank you all for coming in the morning session, that we usually are in the afternoon. So, yep, I will try to start. I think it's the first talk that we'll talk a bit of quantum information properly and so on, so I will try to make it understandable for everyone. So even I have many slides, but I mean, you can stop me at any point. There is no need to get anywhere, okay? And so I'm in CSIC, which is the Spanish Research Council in Madrid. This is the people that has been funding me until a few months ago, and that's what funds me, so Marie Curie and now HAE. I should always say these things. So that's a bit the optimistic outline of the talk. I would talk about control collisions. That's the first project that I started to work on using, trying to use cold molecules for interesting things. Didn't work out so well, so we switched to molecular ions. And studying this project, this will be the main part of the talk where most of the material will be. So as a kind of spin-off project from this, we identified what could be a molecular ion qubit. And so the last part, if I reach here, is what I am doing now, that is ions and dipoles, how we could use an ion to measure an electric dipole moment or do something with it, okay? So I will start by measuring scattering properties with control collisions. This comes from an idea that Tommaso here put forward with some colleagues around 2000, having, if you have atoms trapped in neighboring letter sites and you have an overall harmonic potential around here, they suggested to put the atoms in a superposition state in such a way that one of the states would stay trapped in this optical lattice while the other wouldn't, and then because of the harmonic trapping potential, so they, each atom would go the other way. And after so half of a period, no, one period would be going and coming back, so after half of a period, each one would be back at the center of the optical lattice, and you could put again, close this optical lattice, but measuring the phase that has been accumulated because of the collision, you could get information on the scattering length of the atoms. And so an experiment along these lines was done by the group of Bloch, so in 2003, and in this way they could also get evidence of building some many-body entanglement in a lattice, moving all the ions around the lattice, something like this. Then, inspired a bit by these ideas with atoms and essentially measuring global properties of the potential, like the scattering length, we tried to see if new trapping devices like this holographic mask and so on that allow you to make more fancy lattices and to change them in a smooth way in real time and so on, if we could do something more fancy if we trap several species. And so my figure is not so elaborate because I am not so good with drawing, but the idea would be that I would have, for example, either an atom here and another one in a nearby optical lattice site, or two molecules or whatever you want to put there. And then I would displace the lattice site a little bit and come back, so not really fully going on top of the other one as was the initial proposal, but just a little bit, and in this way you could, in principle, be sensitive to the long range of the potential. And we wanted to suggest these ideas to measure C6 and this kind of coefficients in an interferometric way. So going and coming back and seeing the phase that you have accumulated. So then, well, that's a bit theoretic, how I would calculate these things. So the phase essentially is how the energy changes with time, and I calculate it in this way. So that's a bit of technical details if anyone is interested. But at the end of the day, so I got the results that didn't look so great because the phase I would accumulate would be quite small, so 10^-3 radians for the case of lithium and cesium. That was the experiment that with this kind of lattices that Cheng Qing was suggesting to do. So that was a bit disappointing. So it's one of these results that you never get to publish because it doesn't look so exciting.
So wait, I mean, why do we think that 10^-3 is bad?
I mean, well, I would like to see phases of the order of pi, something like this.
But still, I mean, in the experiment, or right, I mean, like in atomic clocks, people measure actually very, very small phases. So
Yes, but maybe then, I mean, you would be asking for a very big effort for measuring something that I don't know if the people would be so
excited. I guess you would have then to kind of be able to tell the difference between 10 to the minus 3 and 10 to the minus 3 plus 10 to the minus 5 or something like that. I think that's, you can, you know, I don't know.
I mean, it's instinct.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's just a total, but then kind of you will probably have some errors in the errors.
Yeah. I mean, the model, it has a number of approximations, so it might be a bit tricky.
If you want to measure six, say, with 0.1% precision, where it would be interesting.
Yeah, because the error that they have so now, I think it's the typical calculations have an error of like 1%. For 0.1%. So then it would be difficult to compete with that. But nevertheless, I mean, this would be a measurement, because what I have seen is that mainly the people compare different C6 of different calculations, but there are not many direct measurements as far as there is. So that was part of the motivation of really making a measurement. But if the error bar will be compatible with all the theories, then it's not so important.
Did you achieve processes of the phase equivalence?
Well, in principle, what the way to increase your phase would be, for example, to move here and then wait for some time at the shorter distance, so that you are accumulating phase for a certain whole time, then going back. That could be a way to accumulate more phase. But of course, you have to make sure that everything is quite stable, the position of the lattice. I mean, if I put one on top of the other, then I am not only sensing C6, I would see also the short range. So I wanted to really be able to say that I am only sensitive to the long range.
So, on the next slide, you have the phase there is the dynamical phase, it's just the integral of the energy. Do you have to worry about a Berry phase since you're doing
So I should compare with not moving around, but so that's just a bit of the scheme of the steps that I follow. Yes.
So what about Rydberg atoms, right? For example, if you were to characterize
the interaction.
The Rydberg interaction. Mm-hmm. So the coefficients are much larger than.
The interaction would be much smaller.
Yeah, probably nobody has measured them anyways.
Well, it's an idea. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Why? Well, because it's trapped in ground in excited state. At the same time, it's tricky. I mean, people are working on that, but it's not easy to trap Rydbergs in the labs.
Well, but even trapping a Rydberg, so seeing the interaction of a Rydberg with a non-Rydberg, something like this. Yeah, but then having it trapped, leaving it for a while in the excited state and moving it around all together, I don't know how realistic it is.
But if you want to measure the C6 of a molecule, then Rydberg doesn't help you much.
No, but I mean, in general, it's measuring C6 of something. So either two atoms, no. Of course, molecules is, but it is. I mean, C6 is a way of putting it, but it is to measure the dominant term at long range without caring much for the short range, because in this kind of measurement, you only see the overall effect of the potential, because the collision takes short range and long range.
In your treatment, you consider that like the exchange and this, all the things have an analogy to tunneling, right?
I wouldn't let them get so close enough that they really change. So there would only be a small overlap of the two wave functions here.
Yeah, like, as far as I know, like atoms hop largely because of photon scattering there, right? Like in experiments, can you go to the regime that's?
I would imagine that they are nicely trapped here and they don't hop around.
Well, but if they are nicely trapped, then the probability of tunneling is also lower.
Yes, but I mean, you get that closer until the two Gaussians or whatever overlap enough. I mean, that's what you have to estimate. Depending how strong is the interaction, how close you have to be. And given that, how uncertain is this position, no? Because if you have to get 1 nanometer apart to see something, that probably is not very useful, because your uncertainty in the position is bigger and the relative position of the lattices. So this would work if you can stay a few hundred nanometers apart and be sensitive to that.
So how large is the error we get from that, or from the variation in the phase from the non-locality of the
particle? I wouldn't be able to give you a number right now. I mean, already the number is quite small, so the error.
Well, you probably said that, but how will you control the position in experiments? So how much error will you get from that?
To a few hundred nanometers, they can do it. The proposal they made was that they could control that to a few hundred nanometers.
And so you can still improve the C6 in this way because of this. I'll introduce an error.
Have you tried to see the effect on omega v for the potential in terms of frequency shift? Like, for instance, the experiments of casting fault of the Cornell group for the C6T. Because as you approach omega v, is deformed by the potential. So you can see this frequency shift.
Yeah, but I would imagine that this effect is rather small. Because, I mean, typically the harmonic oscillator lens will be quite big compared with the characteristic length of the potential. So I take this in a sense just as a way to move the atom around. In a sense, that's what I put in the way that I model the interaction. So from if the two wells are separate enough, I consider that each one is just in its harmonic oscillator. And if I get them close, then there is a solution for the C6 potential without trap. So in this sense, I would not be able to assess that in the way that I calculated that. That might be an interesting way to see how.
Because for a metallic surface, and atoms and a group of Cornell, you have able to measure the frequency shift to determine the cutting order of densities.
It's even more complex than this simple system. So the error would be even bigger, whatever it is. Satisfied. So the conclusion was I was not satisfied. Okay, so that looked not very promising. So we decided to go to something more strongly interacting, that we didn't have to care for such small numbers. Okay, so then we joined the ideas of cold molecules with quantum ions, that we know that they interact quite strongly and they are under very good control and make molecular ions. Okay, so that's the idea that we had. So just we had a talk by Eric Hudson and someone talked of trapped ions.
The interactions, how do you can you extract C6?
I am not going to extract C6. I am changing subject. But I try to make it look linked so that
talk
is. I am telling you different things, but now I am not going to send C6. Okay, I'm going to do molecular spectroscopy at some point. But just a refresher of how ions are trapped, usually it's this kind of device or some variant of that, quadruple trappers. This has been, there have been some discussions about that, of how this goes. So, you know, you have these four electrodes, you put the ionoid opposite to some positive potential, and these two to negative potential, and then you change that very quickly. So that the electric field that you would have in a plane over there is you have these two positive, these two negative. And so the electric field pushes in one direction and out in the other. And when you switch the voltages, it's the other way around. Okay? So if you are exactly in the center, you are in this point. So this thing is rotating, or it's changing. So if you are exactly in the center, you are in a bit of an unstable position. But if you move, if you are off center, then that will this change of potential will be moving you around. Okay? You will follow this kind of orbit. Okay? And then these small wiggles are this famous micro motion. That is a source of experimental uncertainty for some things, okay? And then, but nevertheless, this works, and you can trap ions. You can either trap one, two, or many of them, or even in a line, something like this. The typical spacing is of the order 1 to 10 microns between the ions. And in a sense, the size that you see of the dot, so that really means that here there is an ion. And the size of the dot would be this wiggling due to the micro motion, okay? But, so these ones are very well center, and this move a bit more because they are off the center of the trap. Okay, so that's how you trap ions, atomic ions, and so here are a bit of characteristics of the system. So of course that's in a vacuum. Typical temperature that you would associate with this motion is the order of 1 to 10 millikelvins, and you will describe the internal state as a qubit, so a superposition of two states, 0 and 1, that the 0 is the south pole and the north pole, and you move around this sphere. And with atomic ions, they have done all sorts of operations moving around the sphere, and everything can be done with great precision. So we will try to see if one can do something similar with molecules. But first, so here I present a sort of a business card for an atomic qubit ion, okay, that's a typical example, calcium 40. It's called an electronic or optical qubit because these are the two qubit states, that is the ground state. Of course, it has a very long lifetime. And as the state one, you take this d 5/2, as this is 5/2 and this is 1/2. In principle, there is no dipole transition. So if you are up here, it will take a long time for this guy to decay, so about a second or something like this. Nevertheless, you can create superpositions between the two, either putting a very powerful laser so that you go beyond the dipole, or doing some Raman transition somewhere else. So this works, okay? So in a sense, this is telling you this is the presentation card of this guy, no? These are my qubit states, and you operate me in this way. And to know in what internal state I am, you use fluorescence and a cyclic transition, that is, you send light resonant with this frequency. And if you see many photons scatter, so that's a cyclic transition. No. These are devices to get the people to follow the talk. That's a cyclic transition. So if you get many photons scattered, that means that you are in this state. If you don't get any, that means you are in this one that doesn't care about the light that you are sending. Okay. But it's good that you paid attention. So that's how atomic ions work. For molecular ions, for the moment, we don't have a qubit yet, but we will have in a few minutes. I don't know if I'm running a bit, but OK. Now, molecular ions, just a brief. We had the talk of Eric, but nevertheless, I will review a few experiments that have been done in a different way that is trying to create these molecular ions in well-defined internal states. And so we had in 2010 a kind of flurry of papers about this from different groups, Drusen in Aarhus, Schiller, I never remember. I think it's Düsseldorf, but I'm not sure. And Stefan Gulich in Basel, okay? So these two follow a more or less similar idea because they are working, I think, Drusen with magnesium hydrate, and Schiller is interested in these things to look for parity violation and this stuff. And so they put these guys in an ion trap, and so that would be the typical bottom of the interaction potential of these guys. You have a vibrational state, so all these are B equals 0 and many more, B equal 1. And you have the rotational state, 0, 1, 2. And so these blue arrows indicate the transitions that are induced by the background, black body background radiation. And so what they do is they would shine a laser for some transition here that pumps population upstairs, but then decays at some point down to J equals 0. So that acts a bit like a dark state, so that after some time, the population accumulates here. And that's actually what they measure in the experiment. These are the different rotational states of equal zero. Initially, you have the red distribution of population that is compatible with the thermal distribution. And after pumping like this for a few seconds, so you can accumulate quite a lot of population in the lowest states. They improve this from this experiment to around 80% or something like this, okay? So this is how these two experiments roughly work, and the Willett experiments prepares the ions in a different way, so it's the two approaches that we have seen typically, and I will explain this in more detail because that's the collaboration that we set out to do. So in his experiment, he starts with neutral nitrogen molecules, molecular beam, that is this thing, and as they are flying, ionize these molecules with a 2+1 transition, that is this thing. You are in the ground, a vibrational state, and some low rotational state, and with two photons of the same wavelength, you go to an excited state of the still of the neutral molecule, but applying, knowing the wavelength of this thing and selection rules, and knowing the spectroscopy of nitrogen, so in principle you know where you are going. And then with a third photon that is of a different wavelength, and this you can change, you ionize the molecule, and you can decide in what rotational state you are ending up. Okay, so that's the ground electronic strain of the molecular ion, and you choose the rotational state. Okay, and so they could populate either n plus equals zero, so the ground state here, or three, selectively playing with the selection rules and the wavelength of this guy. Okay? So these are these three photons, and when you have created these molecular ions, just let them fly into a crystal of calcium ions. This is inside one of these ball traps, and so because of the trap, they are trapped, and because of the interaction with the calcium ions, they are cooled. Okay, and so in the end, you have two species crystal. Okay, and when they have the nitrogen here, they were able to probe these populations. Okay, and they were able to prove that more than 90% of the population was in the ground electronic state. Okay? And they didn't measure any population in the others when they targeted this state. Okay? So that's quite good, because that means you are quite efficiently creating population in this exact quantum state. The bad news for us was the way that they detected it. The way they detected it was they released some argon into the chamber and excited this molecular ion to some excited electronic state, and then by a process known as light-induced charge transfer, this excited nitrogen ion decays into a neutral ion, and the charge is transferred to the argon. Okay, so then here in this kind of pictures, you see that here you had the nitrogen ion accumulated in the center. That's why it's darker. And after doing this thing with the argon and everything, this hole has been replenished with calcium ion. So that means nitrogen ions that you have lost. And so in this way, you count how many you have. So that's a good way to count them. But of course, at the end of the day, you have destroyed your ion. So you made a big effort. You create your molecular ion in a well-defined state, but then you destroy it. So that, for us, that was a very important result. That's why it's a PRL. But for us, as, let's say, quantum scientists, it was a bit disappointing. And so we set ourselves in this collaboration to try to find a way of detecting the internal state of the molecule without destroying it.
Can you repeat this experiment several times?
And not me.
Well, you just learn in average how many. Do you need to know exactly how many ions you have there? Because if I do experiment 100 times, and in average I have 100 ions. I know that if I do one more, I would expect to have 100 without actually having to detect them.
Yes, but if you want to do spectroscopy, for example, that means that, every time you have to start all the process again, put the beam, ionize the beam, and all this, so it takes time. If you cannot destroy it, and you can probe the ion repeatedly, so your repetition rate of the experiment increases, and so you, in the same time, you will get more precision if you do spectroscopy, for example.
So if you cannot probe it, probably it's a bit harder to do quantum information.
I mean, for a spectroscopy, you could do whatever. If you don't destroy it, then you can think of doing several operations, one after the other of the guy. But if after the first one you are done. So that was our motivation, try to look for a non-destructive protocol. And so I showed you already the bicycle. How one detects ions like calcium. So there are a few like this. There are other states with beryllium, ytterbium, so there is a handful of them that something like this works. But of course, there are many ions where these cycling transitions don't exist. So this,
see,
have no cycling transitions. Like, for example, aluminium. So here it's very easy. If you go upstairs, you always decay in the same state. So that's a cycling transition. If you can decay into many, or simply it's very hard to know exactly where you are going, so then this kind of process doesn't work. This is, of course, well known. And so the people already found a solution for this problem. So particular case of interest would be with aluminium, because it has these two transitions that are quite narrow, especially this one. So this one is proposed to be used to build a clock, because it's very narrow. But because exactly it's very narrow, so it's not a cycling transition. So people at NIST in Boulder wanted to find a way to probe these transitions in a quantum way, but knowing that you cannot see directly the internal state. And so the way that they found a solution was to couple one of these difficult ions, like aluminium, with an easy one, like beryllium. And so the coupling comes just from the Coulomb interaction. And so they devised this so-called quantum logic spectroscopy. That the idea is that you trap one ion of each in an ion trap, only one of each. You cool that to the ground state of the motion in the trap. Okay, that's what this n equals zero means. So there are no excitations in the harmonic oscillator. And up and down mean the internal state of each one of the ions. So down would be this for aluminium and this for beryllium, and up would be, I'm not sure, one of these for beryllium and either this or this for aluminium. Then you would probe to make this excitation. So you would send a photon with a certain wavelength. And if the excitation really works, so you would drive this guy up here. So that's just an internal excitation of this ion. And then you shine another photon that is almost resonant with this transition to drive it back, but it's slightly red detuned, so it's a red sideband, which means that you de-excite the ion, you go back to its internal state, but part of the energy has gone to the motional state of the two ions. Okay? So now the two ions coherently are in n equal one. Okay, so they are moving. So typically in the common mode, so that means that they will be both of them shaking in this way. And finally, you apply a photon that would be also a right sideband, but in this case for beryllium. So this would drive, if beryllium is in this excited state, sorry, in the ground internal state, it would drive it to the excited one, but with n equals zero. So you excite the couple to move like this, and with this last photon, you stop the motion, but excite internally beryllium, okay? And then you can detect efficiently whether beryllium is in its up state or down state. So you apply these three photons, and doing this, you have transferred the information on the internal state of the aluminium atom to beryllium. So without directly accessing this guy, you can see what internal state it is, okay? So that's what is called quantum logic spectroscopy. And in this particular case, that was the first experiment that they did, it relies on the motional state in the trap. As I said, you have to see the guys moving together. So this is works, but it's experimentally demanding because you have to cool exactly to the ground state in the trap. You can do that, but it is difficult. That's called sideband cooling. It is also slow because the gate cannot be quicker than the inverse of the trap frequency. It gives you this typical time scale for the motion in the trap. Okay, so really you are exciting one and there is energy transfer from one to the other ion. And again, it only works for relatively simple ions that you can really do a simple excitation like that with one photon, something like this. So it works, but it has a few drawbacks. And so that's a kind of cartoon picture of what's going on here, basically, because of the common modes. I mean, if someone is not very used to what's going on, that's a semi-classical picture of what happens. When you apply a force on this guy will move around. And because they are talking to each other by the Coulomb interaction, this guy will also realize and start to move. That's why you excite one guy, but the two move. Okay, by the common mode, so that's it. Just to get an idea of what's the physical picture going on. But for more complex ions, like molecular ions, that thing would typically not work. And we would also like to beat this requirement of a long time for the gate. And so to do that, there is some solutions that are what are called quantum phase gates. And for this kind of gate to work, we will need these ingredients, and we'll see how to implement them with molecular ions. Okay, so we will need a harmonic oscillator, state-dependent forces, and then some molecular structure calculations for molecules. So the idea of these phase gates is that if you have a particle in a harmonic oscillator, like you could say two ions in an ion trap, you can describe them by the common mode, so center of mass and relative coordinate. Okay, and each one of them would be described by a harmonic oscillator. And Okay, these are the normal modes, and so if you put the description of one of these normal modes in an orbit, if you don't do anything, so that's in phase space, would simply be classically one orbit like this. Now, if you apply some kicks, some forces to this coordinate, like the center of mass or whatever, so you start an orbit here, you're moving around here, and here you make a kick, you change your orbit, and the momentum kick is over, so then you continue moving along this orbit. You do a second kick, you can do that several times. So you can design a series of kicks such that after some time you are exactly back to the same initial point. And the only thing that happens to your quantum state is that it has acquired a phase. Okay, this phase is essentially this area that you have swept around here. Or if you go to the rotating frame with that rotation, so that would correspond to this area. Okay, so all that is happening is you acquire a certain phase, and so it's geometric in nature, so it really doesn't depend on all the details of the path that you are following around here. So you can either do it with these four kicks, or you could probably acquire a certain phase with eight kicks, or maybe with a smooth force that moves you around in a smooth way. Doesn't matter. The only important thing is the area that you sweep. So that makes these kind of schemes quite robust experimentally, because you can design several ways to do it. Another advantage is that you can see that the same set of kicks or forces would impart the same phase to any point in phase space. So that means in practice that you are independent of the initial state and therefore temperature independent. Because it doesn't matter if you are in sort of the ground state in the center or if you are far away. All the states would accumulate the same phase.
This probably relies on the fact that you have purely anomalies. Okay? So any anomaly is going to change this.
But it's quite a good approximation. For small displacements. Of course, here we don't know. I have not put any scale.
Are you saying if you give it from the model oscillator, this formula does not apply? Proportional to the area.
I am not using what, sorry?
Suppose you're not dealing with a perfect harmonic oscillator. Do you still have this?
No, if it's not a perfect harmonic oscillator, then it's not.
Suppose
like
the orbit
Then it would depend on the exact path that you are following in phase space. If it's not perfect harmonic oscillator, then it's no longer geometric in this sense. So it will depend on.
But the thing is that the guy would not even go back to its initial wave function, right? Mm-hmm. So you would have, I mean, your fidelity will be killed not so much by the geometric phase, but by the fact that
you are not.
The wave function will not refocus because you have that
will.
So if you have harmonics.
Okay.
So that's really essential, but it is completely. I mean, it is fulfilled for many more excitations than you have there for any chance. Mm-hmm.
Eric Hudson mentioned actually that you don't have this rotating fields in experiment, but you have like switching fields, which is not exactly like what people refer to like as you did usually.
Yeah, but this rotation has nothing to do with the fact that the pole trap. Okay.
Does this influence fidelity in a way, or is mm-hmm. just
no? Because really the displacements you are doing here are extremely small.
The harmonic approximation is always fulfilled at the moment.
Yes. On top of that, you have some micro motion, but that hopefully should not affect too much. Otherwise, the experiments they have done would not have worked, I think.
Yeah.
Okay, so this looks like an attractive idea because it gives some experimental robustness to the kind of experiment you are going to do. So. The lasers you're using and so on, and also with temperature. You don't have to do this sideband cooling to the N equals zero. So that is really experimentally very interesting. Okay, so that's for this case of a harmonic oscillator. And so the way that we will apply these kicks that we say here, of course, how do you do that? So you can do it in different ways depending on your system. So for example, if you have calcium, for example, that you know its levels and so on, so you can apply laser with some polarization and whatever. So in this way, depending on your internal state, you would see or not see this laser light. So if you are here and you apply light with a sigma minus polarization, because you are coupling these states with this, so you will probably feel a phase shift, and so you will be pushed in some way. Well, if you apply sigma plus, it doesn't go anywhere, so the guy would not care. So in this way, you can apply a force that depends on the internal state of the guy, because this same light would couple with some other internal states. And similarly, you can apply magnetic fields if you want. So if your particle has a magnetic moment, if you put a magnetic field gradient, depending on the magnetic moment, it will sense more or less this force and get, so here, bigger or smaller kick. Okay, so that's the way to give the kicks to particles. And so the physical picture in this case, I would write it in this way. So I would have calcium here, let's say in state zero, and nitrogen in state zero, and then I apply different forces on the two guys. Okay, so for example, I apply a laser, the tuned laser to this guy, and so depending on its internal state, it will feel more or less force, so that means it will be displaced more or less from the previous position. And in nitrogen, I apply another force, either another laser or a magnetic field or whatever, it will also be displaced. And because of that, the state of the two particles will acquire phase that depends on the internal state of the two guys. Okay? Yeah. That's essentially the kind of equation that you have to solve to find the exact phase. And so actually, this comes from paper of Juan Jorge Ripoll, Peter Sol, Ignacio Cirac in 2003 or something like this. That gives you exactly the phase that you accumulate when you apply these forces, okay? As a function of the forces, you get this here. So that's only this geometric phase, okay? The other phases have been taken out. And so here you see that in the same time, if you apply a bigger force, for example, higher intensity or smaller intensity, something like this, you can accumulate phase much faster, okay? So you can, in principle, they prove that you can be as quick as you want. You just need to apply more force and make the gate as quick as you want. So you don't need to rely on the trapping frequency, because you are only sensitive to the phase that is accumulated, and there is no real energy transfer from one to the other. So now we have the ingredients. We know that we have the ions in a trap that is harmonic. We have to apply a force. So the kind of force that we have to apply, so it depends on our system. As we are interested in nitrogen too, so we did some molecular structure calculation, in this case relatively simple, so what I know that is in a magnetic field, we have to work with the Hamiltonian that has the rotations, spin rotation coupling, Zeeman effect because of the magnetic field, and we had to introduce hyperfine structure. Initially we thought that would be very small, but in the end it's not that small. And so here we have the kind of quantum numbers that you will have, and when you diagonalize this thing, you obtain this sort of Zeeman plot of the energy levels as a function of magnetic field. We calculate it for relatively moderate fields up to 100 Gauss that you can typically see. And you see that it's a feast of levels, 10 or 12 are here. Of course, there are more. So these are the lower ones. The next ones are quite high in energy, so you could not expect to populate them in an ion trap, okay? But in principle, all of this could be populated in a normal ion trap. But the good thing that we see is that essentially all of them are separate. So, I mean, there are no degeneracies in this case, okay? So knowing the energy levels and how they depend on the magnetic field, now we know how we can make force on these ions. And we will put all these ideas together of quantum logic spectroscopy, the initial idea to probe difficult ions, phase gates to do it quickly, and the calculations to know exactly how to make the forces on our ions. And so that gives this new spectroscopy protocol that I try to explain here. First we trap an easy ion like calcium, one of these that can be probed easily with a cycling transition, and a difficult one like could be nitrogen. We don't know the internal state of nitrogen, that's the whole point of the thing. But we can control calcium, so we put it in the ground state, so zero. And here we apply a Hadamard gate, that means we put it in a superposition of 0 and 1, and that amounts to opening the two arms of an interferometer, okay? And so we are following at the same time these two paths of the interferometer, depending on the internal state. And then at this point, we apply these state-dependent forces. Okay, we apply a force on the calcium ion and a force on the nitrogen ion. And so some phase will be accumulated according to that, depending on the internal state of the two guys. At some point, we finish this set of pulses, and we close the interferometer. So we apply an Hadamard gate to close the two arms. And so here, essentially, we accumulate the phase that is related with the difference between these two phases. And here we measure the probability that this guy is in the excited state in one. So if we really, if here we did not do anything, so that no phase is accumulated, so this phase is zero, so these two Hadamards cancel each other, nothing has happened, and the probability of being excited is zero. So if we measure some probability of being excited, that means that here something has happened. And so this probability is directly related with the phase that has been accumulated here. Okay?
Question. So I can see why you don't need the sidebands, but I mean, the tuning and therefore your state-dependent push force is different for different motion states, right?
Yes. For different motional states.
Yeah, or different. So your cooling is motional cooling, that the one that you don't need, the rotational cooling, right?
No, the one I don't need is to cool the center of mass mode, if you wish. Because to a good approximation for all of them, the same phase will be accumulated. As long as the potential behaves like an harmonic potential, the same phase is accumulated.
I see. So it's not so much that you need. Okay. So, but you need then to the phase itself. The absolute phase doesn't tell you anything, but the relative phase
between these two guys.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. That would always be the case. I mean, you an absolute phase, you never know what it is.
Okay. I need to think through this. It's still not completely clear, but it's okay.
Well, we can go through it otherwise again. But we get a bit the idea that what we will do is we'll have these two guys here, do some operations on the easy ion like calcium or beryllium. Okay, that's under control. The only tricky part would be here where we apply force on the two guys. That's the only moment that we do something to nitrogen, for example, or whatever you put here. And here you measure calcium. So after this point, the two ions are in an entangled state. And so here, when you measure in an easy interpretation, I don't want to enter in philosophy, I am projecting the state, okay? But I am not destroying, I mean, many walls and things, no. I'm projecting. So here, this nitrogen will be in a well-defined internal state, but it will be here. I have not lost it. It's still in the trap, and I know its properties, okay? So I can, once I have measured this guy, this guy is not lost. Either it is in 0 and 1, I can put it back to 0, and I can repeat this many, many times to improve my accuracy, if you want, OK? Without having to start again ionizing and all that, OK? So the idea is I will measure this probability, and from this probability, I will know the phase that has been accumulated here, OK? And so to make it more step by step, measure probability, looking at that plot, I know what phase I have accumulated. Then, from that funny equation I showed you before by Juanjo et al, 2003, I can relate this phase to the forces that I applied to the two guys. Now, calcium, I know perfectly. If I apply this laser with this detuning, whatever, I know perfectly the force that I apply, so I know what is going into that integral. And for nitrogen, I know, for example, the magnetic field gradient that I apply. The only thing I don't know is the magnetic moment of the guy. So my only unknown property here is the magnetic moment of my molecule. So measuring this phase, in the end, is telling me what's the magnetic moment of this guy. If I am applying a magnetic field, if I apply an electric field, it will give me the dipole moment, okay? And so with this magnetic moment, I go back to this calculation that we did, of the Zeeman plot, just to put it in scale, all this thing is inside here, that was not resolved in Stefan's experiments initially. And so from this diagram of energy as a function of time, I can deduce the magnetic moment, just doing the derivative. And so we see that these guys have a magnitude of the order of one Bohr magneton, and almost each different state gives a different line. So if I measure, if I am at a magnetic field of 80 Gauss, and I measure a magnetic moment of 0.8 Bohr magneton, so that means I am, well, 0.8 is probably this one. So I am in this blue line, and so that tells me that I am in this state. Okay, so that could be the process of doing the spectroscopy, of measuring in what state I am and what's the magnetic moment corresponding to that. Because of course, this is theoretical calculation that we did with some parameters that are 20 years old or something like this, and so not exactly for the state that we are looking at. So this should be improved, but probably it will look like that. But the first step will look, be to do some spectroscopy to really find where all these levels are. Okay, so that's the core of the result. Yeah? More or less understand how this thing works. Just for those that might be interested, a bit of numbers, how this thing would be. So for this system, the typical trapping frequency for the ion of 1 MHz, so you find that the magnetic field gradient that we would need for to accumulate enough phase in a reasonable time, it's on the order of, say, 10 to 100 teslas per meter. This is a bit big, but this, there are experiments realizing this kind of fields nowadays. And the gate time would be in the hundreds of microseconds, so it's quite good. So you don't have to care much about decay or any such sort of thing. Okay, and you have a further degree of that I didn't tell you about, that is driving the same force, not just making a pulse, but driving inside. But that gives you a further degree of freedom to optimize the force depending on your particular trap. Okay, but all these look like reasonable numbers. And actually, Stefan Gulich is trying to set up this experiment and do it. Yeah. Okay. So doing these calculations, it was not difficult to extend, because Stefan told us, I have done the experiment with nitrogen, but I can equally well do it with oxygen, if that is of any good. So we did the same calculations for oxygen, and so we had the good news. So as I said, for nitrogen, we had this plot of the energies, and the magnetic moments are of the order of one Bohr magneton. And so this allows us to estimate how long it will take by create a superposition of two such states before they decohere. So if I make one such superposition between any of those two hyperfine levels, this phase will typically evolve in something like this. So the difference in magnetic moments between these two states, if I have magnetic field fluctuations, I put them here and after a certain time t, so this will be terrible when I accumulate a phase of, say, 1 radian or something like this. Now, for the best experiments with atomic ions, so they have reduced this down to 1 nanotesla, which is, I think, quite small. And so putting the numbers here, that tells us that for these states of nitrogen, they would dephase after around 1 millisecond. Okay. That's only thinking of magnetic field fluctuations. Of course, there can be other sources of decoherence, but that gives us an upper bound. It will not work better than that. And it's similar for atomic ions.
In this, is there any collisional decoherence?
Well, not in this system in particular, that I only have one ion of each, but if I had a collection, I guess interactions would enter into play. These guys don't collide too much because, of course, Coulomb keeps them apart from each other. But if there is some background gas or something, that can happen. Yeah. So here.
Well, you mean that if they collide under Coulomb potential, the coherence is going to be.
No, I mean that they do not really move, as they are very cold in the crystal, so they don't. So they will not really.
Far apart.
Yeah.
Still a collision.
But basically, I mean, both qubit states accumulate the same phase. Mm-hmm. That's the point. So if both qubit states accumulate the same phase, then this differential phase goes away.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess the main problem would be if there is a background gas that collides with one guy and not the other. That would be bad.
So your background gas pressure is like 10 to the minus 11?
Something like this. Millibar.
So what is that?
That's small, but that's the typical pressures of, I mean, I took it from a thesis or something, so, but there is always something around. But a single ion trap in one of these traps can live for, I think, a year or more, so it doesn't decay. But of course, if you have more. So that is for nitrogen, but then that's when I try to sell these things to the quantum information people. Why do you do this with molecules? They are very complex. Then I always, well, because you have many molecules to choose from, and then if you look at oxygen, which actually has a Hamiltonian that is a bit more horrible because it has more terms, so you don't have hyperfine structure for oxygen 16, doubly magic nucleus, but you have what that's spin orbit. Yeah, I was, because I always have problems between rotation spin orbit. And a lambda double term because the ground state is actually two pi state. Okay, so it's a bit more complex to do, but and also the data are not extraordinarily new. Okay, so it's almost 30 years, and nevertheless you can do a similar plot, and magically you find that where we had 12 states before, now we only have two. The others are three or four Kelvin above, so really that's very high apart. So you can only expect to populate these two in the ground state, and up to very large fields of thousands of Gauss, I mean, you really only see these two guys. And when you calculate the magnetic moment of them, so they are both parallel to each other, and they are 1,000 of a Bohr magneton. So just doing pocket calculation with these things tells you that this guy would take 1 second to dephase because of magnetic field fluctuations. So just changing your molecule in this sense improves a lot. So that is something that I think is quite attractive. And also being a homonuclear molecule is immune to these black body radiations because you cannot excite them. So of course that tells you that this could work very nicely to make a memory, but then the problem is the opposite. How do I operate with a guy that doesn't care of any field around it?
If you have a magnetic field component of things like body radiation, and it's visible.
Yeah, but the magnetic field, I mean, as I tell you, it's not very sensitive. Depends how big it is, but of course, I mean, you will always have to put some shielding. I mean, I don't think that oxygen in this room is now quantum coherent. But it looks like a system that, I mean, going simply from nitrogen to oxygen, it gives you this nice property. Probably it also has nasty
spin
properties.
Spin back or something to remove the fluctuations?
In nitrogen. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, of course. I mean, they have developed many possible ways to deal with these things with atomic ions that you could use with molecular. But I think it's always easier if you find a system where you don't need to care about that.
I have two questions. So I believe it could be done with an ion of this sort, molecular ion of this sort. I'm not sure I understand what would be the advantage of then doing between this with respect to like single atom ions. And I always thought we have been thinking maybe on your nuclear, other molecules for the molecular ion. You have these other degrees of freedom and you can play different games. So what would be the advantage? Why do you pick homonuclear here?
We picked oxygen. The main reason was because the experimentalists told us we can do this experiment. And so we thought, let's do what can be done with it. I think it's a reasonable approach.
But then what would be then the advantage? Because, I mean,
I think
polar, I see the advantage because you have the rotational states and you can...
Well, he also have the rotations and all these degrees, so this changes the rotations here.
But what's the energy scale for that?
Well, now it's a good question, I don't remember. But as I told you, the next levels here that, would be several Kelvin high. So you are really... This doublet is really quite isolated from all the others.
You also have only even levels, right?
Yes. So you're saying the properties in terms of rotational states of this, how do they compare to the properties of rotational states for qubits in terms of a polar molecule?
What I would say is that this guy looks nice to be a memory because it's quite insensitive to other things, but you would not like to use this to make many operations, because it's difficult to couple to it. So you would need large fields, and so you would use maybe a polar molecule that you can manipulate with electric fields and so on to do operations. And then when you want to keep that information, you transfer it to this guy.
But then, so I believe that. But then, I mean, polar molecules would be good enough for memory, right? So what would have, I mean, why would I need?
No, because for example, polar molecules, you have to care about the black body radiation and all these things. So that you need to protect them. They are more fragile. I mean, there is always this trade-off. How is it to access them? And then, of course, if it's easy to access, they will be easy to lose the information, and the other way around. So we just happen to find that this guy, without doing anything, has this nice property.
How do you couple polar molecules to molecular
heads? That's another problem. You can maybe trap this oxygen with a polar molecule and put something in between to go from one to the other, with microwaves or through an atomic ion. I mean, we know how to couple these guys with atomic ions. That's what I have been telling you. And then from that atomic ion, you can couple to the dipole. If I had time, that's what I would tell you in the next part of the talk, but I don't have time. So you will have to wait for the paper to appear.
I just talked to
now, I see that we are...
It's a whole Wednesday afternoon until 4.
Yeah, yeah.
So, well, basically, I mean, this doesn't help with, I guess, I mean, the major problem in this ion quantum computing is the scalability issue, right? So, and this is not going to...
Well, but I was asked a similar question last year at IFA talk in an engineering department in Colombia. And then I was fighting for the answer, but actually the same guy said, well, but a computer with 10 ions, quantum computer with 10 ions would probably already have more power than this.
No.
Because it's, no, and 20.
50 logical.
Yeah, that's...
Meaning 10 to the 6. So,
I mean, you don't need the Avogadro's number of ions.
No,
to compete with these guys.
No, but you need error correction, and that other hand means that to be practical, you need the order of 10 to the 6 if you want to general purpose quantum computer. And you need, let's say, 100 if you want to do quantum simulation that is beyond the classical simulation. So it's not 10, but it is maybe 100 for special purpose.
Yeah. But it's still, I mean, 10 is already pretty good compared.
Yeah, I think it could be, I mean, for the moment, the bigger results we have seen is factorizing 15, no? That I think that my nephew can do. So.
No, it's not true. The biggest result we have seen is the latest quantum simulation by GLAT, where they have 150 quantum gates one after the other, which is equivalent to factorizing much bigger than 15, still irrelevant for factorization. But very interesting for quantum simulation.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So it's like two different.
No, obviously. Thanks.
And this can be useful.
But I mean,
I'm not saying many cases
in
that line. So it's,
I mean, a different system where I don't know. But I think with this, I finished this part. Well, this you might maybe use, look at this point to measure TS, but that's not so exciting. And then I would do this thing that I will not do, but I'm working to trap. Nion and a power molecule to go along.
So you do C2 there, right?
You can call it C2 if you wish. Yeah, that could be this thing. Yes, yes. So I am measuring the dipole moment if you wish. But yeah, so I just was comparing ions, dipoles.
Are you doing the because there is no, like there is no QDT theory for instance for that, right?
I am not an expert.
There is no collision theory.
I think so, no, because that's fully long range. There is no way to know. But so that's it. So I made some numbers, the frequencies you should. So the same idea that I said of harmonic oscillator by forces, everything holds, just you would have to do the forces in a different way, and it's a bit more funny and blah, blah, but in principle you can do it. And so just leave here questions for the future if anyone is interested.
No, maybe you should.
No, you don't get to show anything anymore.
No. Where the money comes from, the people, and thank you all for the discussion.
All right, thank you so much.